The killer, whose name I will not use or ever say, was born in Afghan.
I have an idea about what we can do about ISIL. And it's not necessarily my idea, and it's not necessarily a new idea. But what it is something that a lot of folks are going to be pretty unwilling to try. And the reason why is because it's not going to be profitable for some multinational corporation. It's not going to be profitable for the weapons industry. And there's not going to be a whole lot of fear-mongering and waging war involved in the solution. We'll get to that in a minute. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here on The Fire You Can't Put Out, episode number 165. My name is Melvin, here with you. As always, I appreciate your continued support. Thank you. Thank you for being here. The idea that is so often promoted is that ISIL is Barack Obama's fault, and ISIL is at war with the West. It's very important to understand this framing, because when you put it in this kind of frame, you make everybody feel like they have to be involved. You make people feel like they themselves are the ones who are under attack, you and me. But ISIL doesn't necessarily have an end game. They don't even have a real good plan. So it's been 2 weeks since the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando. And what immediately comes out is the fact that the guy pledged to al-Baghdadi. He called 911 and he pledged to al-Baghdadi, and he said he was doing this for ISIS. But I think that that was just a man who decided that that was going to be his out. I think what we were really dealing with is a gay man who hated himself. And it's not just because parts of his own religion tell him to hate himself, but there are parts of Western religions that tell you to hate yourself as well. But we'll get to that in a minute. ISIL are born directly out of the Iraq war. There's no two ways about that. We decided to go in, and we decided that we were going to bring these people democracy at the end of a barrel, and this is what it got us. And because it's an idea, what they believe in is an idea, a radical one at that, but it's still just an idea. Because they believe in that idea, you cannot kill that idea. I heard Majid Nawaz recently, or Majid, forget how he says his name, the head of the Quilliam Foundation, which is an anti-Islamic extremism think tank. It's the only one in the whole world. And he said, when somebody put a bullet in Osama bin Laden's head, did that kill the movement? No, something far bigger grew out of it. And then he talked about Malala, the young girl. He said, when somebody put a bullet in her head, not only did it not kill her, but it didn't kill the idea either. And here's the thing, you can't kill an idea. And you certainly can't kill an idea with the kind of heavy weaponry that we're using. I've brought it up on the show before, but I used to sing for a punk rock band. And then it looks like that band is starting to pull back together again. And I was re-listening to the old album the other day. And what really struck me was how I was saying that kind of stuff back then. It's embarrassing to create that kind of a record, or potentially embarrassing, because if you say the kind of stark things that I said on that record, and then say 10 years down the road, it's proven to not be true, or you don't know what you're talking about, that could be potentially embarrassing. But as I was listening back to what I said, what I wrote 10 years ago, I said, man, I nailed it. And I'm not a freaking genius. Let's put that out there right now. I'm not a scholar. I don't even hold a college degree. But I'm going on pretty basic ideas. And I got to the ideas that I got, not because somebody shoved a gun in my face, but because these are the ideas that make sense to me. And when I look at the society around me, I see how those ideas work out for other people as well. President Obama carried out some pretty high profile and crippling attacks against Daesh, against ISIL, just about 2 years ago. And at that time, ISIL, realizing that they had lost some of what they built up, decided to put out a call to anyone around the world that would hear their message and sympathize with it. And what they said was, wherever you are, carry out soft attacks, kill as many people as possible. And then, before you either die, finish carrying out the attack, just at some point, because it's likely that you're going to be killed, at some point, say that you did it for ISIS. And no matter who you killed, no matter where you killed them, or how many you killed, that will help further ISIL's cause. That will help further the Islamic State cause. Back in 2004, a senior defense official said, "These latest comments from ISIL demonstrate once again that it remains more interested in pursuing its own violent nihilistic goals rather than advancing any productive agenda for the people of Iraq or Syria. Beyond that, we don't intend to get in a back and forth with ISIL or any other terrorist group regarding its propaganda. These countries, part of the coalition taking on ISIS, were responding to a new audio recording in which a senior ISIS leader for the first time explicitly called for attacks in the United States, home soil, or that of Western allies. The leader specifically called for lone wolf attacks in the United States and France, two countries that have been conducting airstrikes against ISIS in Iraq. The U.S. State Department had no comment to CNN when asked about the message. Quote, hinder those who want to harm your brothers, the ISIS spokesman said. The best thing you can do is to strive to do your best to kill any disbeliever, whether he be French, American, or from any of their allies. Civilians should not be exempt from brutality, he said. Do not ask anyone's advice and do not seek anyone's verdict. Kill the disbeliever, whether he is civilian or military, for they have the same ruling. Both of them are disbelievers. Both of them are considered to be waging war. Oh, Americans and oh, Europeans. The Islamic State did not initiate a war against you as your governments and media try to make you believe, the ISIS spokesman added. It is you who started the transgression against us, and thus you deserve blame, and you will pay a great price. He gave specifics on how to attack Westerners. Rig the roads with explosives for them, attack their bases, raid their homes, cut off their heads. Do not let them feel secure. Hunt them wherever they may be. Turn their worldly life into fear and fire. Remove their families from their homes and thereafter blow up those homes.
For a while now, the main contribution of some of my friends on the other side of the aisle have made in the fight against ISIL is to criticize this administration and me for not using the phrase radical Islam. That's the key, they tell us. We can't beat ISIL unless we call them radical Islamists. What exactly would using this label accomplish? What exactly would it change? Would it make ISIL less committed to trying to kill Americans? Would it bring in more allies? Is there a military strategy that is served by this? The answer is none of the above. Calling a threat by a different name does not make it go away. This is a political distraction.
What we've been hearing from conservatives thus far is we're just not using the right phrasing. And the reason conservatives so badly want us to start saying radical Islamic terrorism, radical Islamic terrorism, radical Islamic terrorism, anytime and all the time is because they very much like the idea of A, their religion going to war with another religion because it makes them feel very good, very self-righteous, like they've got God on their side. And also, conservatives are very much in the camp, with the idea that the way that you defeat ISIS is the way that ISIS is trying to defeat the rest of the world, and that's by killing as many people as possible. But when you argue that we should go to war against a religion, first of all, no, we're not going to go to war against another religion. That's awful. And we're certainly not going to take our military going to war with another religion. And when you argue that we should go to war with another religion, you're playing in to ISIL's hands. You're doing ISIS's work for them.
I'll suggest I won't call this threat what it is. He hasn't been listening. But I will not demonize and declare war on an entire religion.
And if we fall into the trap of painting all Muslims with a broad brush and imply that we are at war with an entire religion, then we are doing the terrorist work for them.
When Omar Mateen carried out his attack in Orlando, killing 49 people, and then he himself was killed by police, what we learned within a week of that slaughter was, A, he had been investigated a couple times by our FBI. And he had bought the AR-15 that he used for the slaughter just about a week before he carried it out. But what we also learned was that he had a Grindr account. Grindr. It's an app. It's a gay app. It's a gay hookup app for guys to hook up with other guys. Patrons for the Pulse nightclub also said that they saw him in the Pulse nightclub plenty of times picking up other guys. So what we learned is that he was probably gay himself. I think it was Majid I heard say. I can't remember. I don't want to credit it to the wrong person. But I once heard someone say, there is nobody more conflicted in the whole world than a gay Muslim. Because there really isn't any part of that particular religion, or honestly any religion, that says that that kind of thing is okay. It's not even acknowledged in the religion. So the immediate thing that happens is conservative pundits get on TV and begin doing ISIS's work for them, screaming at the top of their lungs about how we need to be afraid of ISIS, how we need to go after ISIS, we need to kill ISIS, everybody needs to be afraid, they're coming for you, they're coming for your child, you're going to die. That's the immediate response. But one of the less predictable things was all of the anti-gay pastors that came out and actually praised the nightclub shooting.
Hey, are you sad that 50 pedophiles were killed today? No, I think that's great. I think that helps society. You know, I think Orlando, Florida is a little safer tonight. It is unnatural for a man to be attracted to another man. You know, the tragedy is that more of them didn't die.
There were several other pastors that came out and said roughly the same thing. But when I cut audio for this show, I can only listen to so many American Christian pastors gloating, celebrating the murder of these people. You're no better than the Westboro Baptist Church when you do that. And they say, hey, you know what? This isn't all American pastors. And it's true. It's not. You really can't paint any of them with a broad brush. You say, these are just outliers, right? This guy, Roger Jimenez. All right, this guy's just a... And then there were other... No. These guys... Well, okay. Let's take somebody a little more mainstream, like, say, Tony Perkins.
President Obama has extolled the virtues of fatherhood even as he has fought for same-sex marriage. In essence, saying two same-gendered persons can parent as well as a mom and a dad. This contradictory message is more than disappointing. For our children throughout the country, it is devastating. It reduces mothers and fathers to genderless caregivers. Our children deserve better. They deserve a mom and a dad. And we pay a price for this incoherent ideological campaign by havoc in our homes and blood in our streets.
Tony Perkins is not just some outside whack job. This guy goes on Fox News and conservative talk radio shows all the time, and he is looked up to by the conservatives on the right. And it was a really weird... I consume a lot of conservative media. I've mentioned that before. And it was a really weird week for me to tune into all these right-wing radio shows and to hear them talking about how they are standing up for the gays, right? To hear Sean Hannity, we're standing up for the gays. To hear Donald Trump, we're standing up for the gays. When there's so much anti-gay rhetoric used by them all the time. But hey, it's an election season. Strange bedfellows. Pick your slogan. And that's what's happening now. They're realizing that in order to win the election, they're going to need that constituency. And so they're saying, hey, my gay brothers and sisters, although we disagree on marriage, you should follow what the conservatives want to do. Because the conservatives are really the ones that are looking out for you. These people that got killed in this nightclub by this Islamic extremist, not a gay man who hates himself, an Islamic extremist. Well, we don't want that to happen to you anymore. All of a sudden, conservatives love the gay people, but they don't. And they're not really going to stand up for you. And they don't really care, but they do smell blood.
I'm ashamed to say that. I think I was pretty much on the precipice of committing a terror attack in my home country, in the UK, in London. I was brought up as a Salafi, a Wahhabi, which is a Saudi form of Islam, and I'm also gay. And I think there was this strange kind of dynamic between the two, whereby I would kind of research all of these Islamic verdicts on what you should do if you have homosexual feelings. Not if you're gay, because they didn't accept the whole concept of being gay. No one's gay. God doesn't make anyone gay. So I would research them, and one thing would keep coming up again and again. Be more religious. Worship more. And basically, because I was a Salafi, I became more religious, and that led me to becoming more radical. So it sounds really paradoxical in a sense, but I actually became more radical because I was gay in an attempt to cure myself of my homosexuality.
That's Sahail Ahmed on the BBC. And what he was describing there, and this is what's interesting to me, he's describing the fact that he had these feelings, that he was gay. And he was told within his house of worship, there are no gay people and you cannot be gay. And the way to beat back the gay is to be more religious. And he himself, by his own admission, said the way he was going to do that was he was going to carry out an attack. In the extended interview, he goes on to say that they say, since you can't cure yourself of this, you need to do the ultimate by sacrificing yourself. You need to sacrifice yourself and further our cause by taking some of the infidels with you, by taking some of our enemies with you. And he was going to do that. But then Quilliam came into his life. Quilliam is the anti-Islamic extremist think tank. I almost messed that phrase up. I'm probably messing it up now. Started by Majid Nawaz, who himself also was in the same boat, not gay, but was going to carry out a terrorist attack. He ended up getting caught. He ended up doing 5 years in prison, and he unlearned all of the extremist ideology that he learned throughout his life. He's got a really great book out. You get a chance to read it. Just plug MAAJIDNAWAZ into a search engine, and his book comes up. I've read it, and it's fantastic. But Sahail says he heard about Quilliam. And he looked into it and he began unlearning all of the things that he had learned. And then he decided to start learning about his own sexuality. And in learning about his own sexuality, he said, you know what? I'm gay. And that's all there is to it. And the anti-gay rhetoric that comes out of that religion or any of our world leaders has a real world effect. And it's incredibly destructive. And what we know now about Omar Mateen, because of what he did in his off time when nobody was around, was that it was likely that he was a gay man who hated himself, who decided to do what Sahail was going to do by carrying out an attack and sacrificing himself because he hated himself, because he couldn't square with who he was. And in America, it's incredibly easy to get a weapon and carry out those kinds of attacks.
We should give ATF the resources they need to enforce the gun laws that we already have. People with possible ties to terrorism who aren't allowed on a plane shouldn't be allowed to buy a gun. Enough talking about being tough on terrorism. Actually be tough on terrorism and stop making it easy as possible for terrorists to buy assault weapons.
Oh God, there goes that damn Obama trying to take away our guns again. Pew, pew, pew. And it always goes to the guns.
So, guns, in and of themselves, do not necessarily make one an extremist, to make one want to carry out murders. But, in America, if you want to kill as many people as possible, you can pretty easily obtain one of these weapons, as well as many rounds of ammunition as you want. No questions asked. And then you can carry out your slaughter anywhere you want, at what ISIL refers to as soft targets. And there's that damn Obama trying to take away our machine guns again.
And I do not believe in taking away the right of the citizen to own guns for sporting, for hunting and so forth, or for home defense. But I do believe that an AK-47, a machine gun, is not a sporting weapon or needed for defense of a home.
Okay, fine, fine. So you found an old clip of St. Ronald Reagan saying that we should not have, that we as regular people, we should not have machine guns. Saying that we should not have the power to cut down trees with guns. Fine. You found an old clip. You know, because things were different back then. Things are so different now. Okay, nobody conservative is saying that now. And you know why? Because it's not a good idea. You shouldn't take our guns away. These are our machine guns. We should kill command people. I think people don't realize what it is they're defending. It's not for home defense. It's a gun. Fine. We have them. It's a machine gun. It's a lot of rounds in a short period of time. It kills a lot of freaking people. That's what you're
I'm defending the Second Amendment.
No, you're not. You're defending a murder weapon. And not just any murder weapon. You're defending a murder weapon that can cut houses in half.
Every time we have a mass shooting, we talk about guns, right? Yes, the Orlando massacre was terror. But there's no doubt that Omar Mateen was able to kill so many people because he was firing an AR-15, a military-style assault weapon. A weapon easier to buy in the state of Florida than buying a handgun. Florida sets a 3-day waiting period for purchasing handguns, but the state mandates no waiting period for any gun that requires two hands to hold.
That was Gretchen Carlson on Fox News. And more people are starting to come to where I and a lot of other rational people have been on this issue for some time. And that is, you don't need a machine gun. You don't need an AR-15. And they should be banned. You want to own guns for home defense or hunting? Fine. But you're not hunting with an AR-15. There's not even going to be friggin' meat left. And the other thing, we need to stop doing their work for them. We need to stop making more of them than they really are. We need to stop holding them up so high and making them into warriors. When you say we are at war with Islam, when you say we are at war with ISIS, you make those men warriors. When what they really are, all they really are criminals.
I would not have called this a war. I would have continued what we've been doing before and used the law enforcement instrument and thereby made them the criminals they
right.
are. Treat them as criminals, not as warriors. Look at the problem we had and the issues we created by trying to define them, even in the law, once we had decided to make them warriors. We then decided we had to make them illegal combatants so they couldn't be warriors. They're not warriors.
ISIS.
They're criminals.
One of the worst things that we did after the 9/11 attacks was holding those guys up, making them more than they really were, and then declaring war on them. When the federal building was bombed, the Oklahoma federal building was bombed during the 90s, they got an investigation, they found the guy, they arrested him, they tried him, they put him in prison. Same with the guys in the early, I think it was the early, late 90s. The guys that tried to blow up the World Trade Center, which was eventually taken down in 2001. Found the guys that did it, tried them, they sit in prison to this day. Treat them like the criminals that they are. Because when you start saying things like war, we're going to wage war on them. We're going to send a military we're going to go to war. Then you make them into warriors. You make them something larger than men. Not quite gods, but certainly bigger than they are now.
And by ISIL's own admission, some of its own leaders have been caught stealing cash and gold. Once again, ISIL's true nature has been revealed. These are not religious warriors. They are thugs, and they are thieves.
And that's it. And the president has been criticized in the past for calling them the JV team. And he hasn't walked it back. And you know what? I don't think that he should. Because they are the JV team. What gives them power is how savvy they are on social media. What gives them power is how much we talk about them on the news and how we talk about them in terms where our hair is on fire when we do it. And we talk about them like they are this big, overreaching, massive, but they're not. We make them into that. And we make them into that because fear. Fear does a lot of good for folks who profit off of this industry. The media profits off of this. Gun manufacturers profit off of this. Military contractors profit all of this. And fear. Fear always makes the wolf seem bigger than it really is.
Why then do you and Hillary want to control and restrict and limit gun manufacturers, gun owners, and the responsible use of guns and ammunition to the rest of us, the good guys, instead of holding the bad guys accountable for their actions. And, Mr. President, if I may, I'd like to use Chicago, your hometown, a city that has some of the strictest gun laws in the nation, a city that for decades and still is under Democratic control, a city that has an outrageous and even embarrassing murder rate, as my first example. Why can't we round up these thugs, these drug dealers and gang members, and hold them accountable for their actions, or allow the good people in Chicago access to firearms to protect themselves?
Allow me to take that apart. Okay, so this man stood up at a forum that PBS was having, and that man was asking that question directly to President Obama, and he hit every single right-wing talking point in a matter of 40 seconds. Chicago, they always hold up Chicago. And yes, there's a lot of murder and crime in Chicago, but they, and even with the strict gun laws there, the surrounding states do not have the same laws. So you need a nationwide law in order for that kind of thing to work. He pointed out it's Democrats. It's because Democrats run the whole thing. And then, of course, the solution was more guns. Why can't they have more guns? More guns. The solution is always going to be more guns. He nailed every single right-wing talking point that is just bandied about with this whole thing. But the president kept his cool, kept his composure. Why do you want to take guns away from law-abiding citizens? Easy, Skeeter, easy. But the president answered him. And answered him with the class and grace that he always does.
First of all, the notion that I or Hillary or Democrats or whoever you want to choose are hell-bent on taking away folks' guns is just not true. I don't care how many times the NRA says it. I'm about to leave office. There have been more guns sold since I've been president than just about any time in U.S. history. There are enough guns for every man, woman, and child in this country. And at no point have I ever proposed confiscating guns from responsible gun owners. So it's just not true. What I have said is precisely what you suggested, which is why don't we treat this like every other thing that we use? We used to have really bad auto fatality rates. The auto fatality rate has actually dropped precipitously, drastically, since I was a kid. Why is that? We decided we had seatbelt laws. We decided to have manufacturers put airbags on in place. We decided to crack down on drunk driving and texting. We decided to redesign roads so that they were less likely to have a car bank. We studied what is causing these fatalities using science and data and evidence, and then we slowly treated it like the public health problem it was, and it got reduced. We are not allowed to do any of that when it comes to guns, because people, if you propose anything, it is suggested that we're trying to wipe away gun rights and impose tyranny and martial law. Do you know that Congress will not allow the Center for Disease Control to study gun violence? They're not allowed to study it, because the notion is that by studying it the same way we do with traffic accidents, somehow that's going to lead to everybody's guns being confiscated. When we talked about background checks, if you buy a car, if you want to get a license, first of all, you got to get a license. You have to take a test. People have to know that you know how to drive. You don't have to do any of that with respect to buying a gun. And when we talked about doing effective background checks, it was resisted because the notion was we were going to take your guns away. I just came from a meeting today in the Situation Room in which I've got people who we know have been on ISIL websites, living here in the United States, U.S. citizens, and we're allowed to put them on the no-fly list when it comes to airlines. But because of the National Rifle Association, I cannot prohibit those people from buying a gun. This is somebody who is a known ISIL sympathizer, and if he wants to walk in to a gun store or a gun show right now and buy as many weapons as ammo as he can, nothing's prohibiting him from doing that, even though the FBI knows who that person is. So, sir, I just have to say respectfully that there is a way for us to have common sense gun laws. There is a way for us to make sure that lawful, responsible gun owners like yourself are able to use it for sporting, hunting, protecting yourself. But the only way we're going to do that is if we don't have a situation in which anything that is proposed is viewed as some tyrannical destruction of the Second Amendment. And that's how the issue too often gets framed.
So the exchange between the president and that gun nut, and the creepy thing about that is what he says there at the end. If we know that there's somebody that's a potential terrorist, but we don't have a lot of evidence, but we, you know, we've got this, that, and the other that can say that this guy might carry out attacks. There's nothing we can do to stop that man from buying a gun, because lawmakers have done nothing with respect to restricting even those guys from getting guns. This exchange happens just a couple of weeks before Orlando. And then essentially what the president described there at the end, well, that's exactly what happened in Orlando. Omar Mateen was on their radar, but hadn't done anything. So they couldn't do anything to him, not even stopping him from buying a gun, even though they knew that he had the potential. They still couldn't do anything about it, and that's because Congress won't do anything about it. There was a Muhammad drawing contest in Texas about a year ago, just over a year ago. And the reason they decided to do that in Texas is because they know that some cartoonists have been killed around the world for drawing Muhammad in an unflattering light. And so you could say these rednecks down there in Texas were just trying to find a way to make a shooting happen. And you know what happened at the Muhammad drawing contest? A shooting happened. And when it happened, ISIS, they immediately claimed credit, saying it was theirs, even though there was absolutely no evidence. This from Alexander Smith at NBC, how ISIS capitalizes on lone wolves to spread terror at no cost. Quote, ISIS provided no evidence to support its claim but the shooting at the Prophet Muhammad cartoon contest, but experts told NBC that accepting responsibility was a cheap way for the militants to achieve their terroristic goals. Quote, lone wolves are a low-cost, low-resource way to carry out attacks, where the group can then retroactively decide if it wants to claim responsibility or not, said J.M. Berger, co-author of ISIS, The State of Terror, and a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institute. If they like it, he said, they can adopt it after the fact. It's incredibly expensive to carry out terrorist attacks, but they've managed to do so in a way, thanks to the internet, without spending any money and without training anybody. After those crippling attacks by our military, by military drones, roughly 2 years ago, they put out this thing saying, kill as many people as possible. Go after what are referred to as soft targets. They said, don't travel to Iraq. Don't travel to Syria. Stay wherever you are. Find whatever weapon you can and kill as many people as you can. Quote, inspiring lone wolf attackers has been the holy grail of terrorist groups for decades because they can generate destruction and worldwide publicity without spending money or resources. ISIS has had an unparalleled success, according to Berger and David Gartenson Ross, senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, because of ISIS' very good social media game. ISIS typically claims responsibilities when attackers have posted messages usually on Twitter, pledging allegiance to the group or its leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. U.S. officials have credited drone strikes carried out by the CIA and the military's Joint Special Operations Command with putting al-Qaeda on its heels. Officials have long said that Hellfire missiles fired from unmanned drones are far more precise than conventional bombing when it comes to targeting terrorists living among civilians. It is not seriously disputed that the U.S. targeted killing operations, however, outside of active war zones, have become less frequent and more discriminating in recent years. The main reason for that, officials say, was Obama's decision in 2013 to impose rules that such attacks may only be carried out if there's a near certainty that civilians won't be harmed. The Long War Journal, a project of the right-leaning Foundation for Defense of Democracies think tank, whose numbers tend to be most favorable to U.S. policymakers, tallied 207 civilian casualties since 2009 in 492 drone strikes in Pakistan and Yemen. That does not include strikes in Somalia and Libya, which the Obama administration includes in its count of around 100. New America, a left-leaning Washington think tank, counted between 244 and 294 civilians killed in 547 attacks in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia. The Bureau of Investigative Journalism estimates that as many as 1,068 civilians were killed in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia, the vast majority since 2009. The way that we are carrying out attacks against these terrorists is in and of itself terrorism. The CIA, by its own admission, sometimes does not know who it's killing. And that has led to more of this. And this brings us back around to where we began. You cannot win over these people in these regions. You cannot win hearts and minds by carrying out terrorist attacks yourself. The problem with George W. Bush was when he started the war, he thought you'd just go in, storm, kill, everything will be great. No, it destabilized and gave us what we have now. So Obama comes in and says, we're not going to put boots on the ground. I know that's a dehumanizing term and I don't like to use it, but he said, we're not going to put boots on the ground. We're going to use these targeted drone strikes. None of our men and women will get killed. Right, but lots and lots of their people will be killed. In 2013, the JSOC carried out a strike in Yemen that killed 12 people that were deemed militants. But local officials said the strike hit a wedding party, and the CIA analysis could not say with confidence that all the dead were combatants. They actually killed the members of a wedding party. What we're doing, our official policy, is only leading to more terrorism. So, as I always say, it's not enough to get on this mic and just piss and moan about everything that's wrong. We need a solution. So, Melvin, what's the solution? Thank you for asking. Right now, we're spending billions in the short term, trillions in the long term. I believe our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have already surpassed $2 trillion. We're heading into the third trillion. And what do we have? And nobody realizes how much money that is. That's $1,000 million. What do we have to show for spending several trillion dollars? Well, we have a lot of dead people. We have a lot of destruction. We have an entire region that does not trust us and does not believe in us and does not want us in their homeland anymore. We essentially, at this point, have nothing to show for all of that money that we've spent, for all that blood and treasure. So what could we do? Well, there's another solution, but we're still going to have to spend money. But we're going to have to spend maybe a tenth of that much money. What ISIS does right now is they go into these regions. Now, from that last story I read, you heard me say they're having trouble finding a way to kill them because they're amongst civilians. Well, then why don't the civilians just kill them if they know that they're ISIS? ISIS has its own magazine. ISIS has its own police force. ISIS also has its own welfare office. You heard me right. What they do when they go into these regions is they say to these people, you're hungry? We will provide you with food. You need a house? We will provide you with housing. You need electricity? We will get you electricity. But you will live under us. That's a heavy hand, but their human needs are being met. And the people just go ahead and deal with it. And they say, okay, we'll allow ISIS in. We'll live under ISIS because, hey, yeah, they're a terrorist group, but it's a lot better than the Americans coming over here with their drones and killing all of our people. That's something that we can't handle. That's something that we cannot stand for. What we could do that's a lot less profitable, but a lot more effective, nobody's going to get rich off of this, is take a small piece of that money, move most of our forces out of there, stop the drone strikes. And I'm not one of these guys that, you know, on the right, when I tune into conservative talk radio shows, by and large, it's nothing but just defending the indefensible. It doesn't matter what somebody does, as long as they're a Republican, they're in the right, and as long as they're a Democrat, they're in the wrong. But that's not this show, because I can't lie to myself, and I'm not going to lie to you either. Yeah, what Bush did was wrong, but what President Obama is doing is also wrong. We have a kill list, and that's not a good way to get things done. We could go in there with our military, not our guns. We could go to those same people, offer them more than what ISIS is offering them, and they will give up ISIS. ISIS only works because they have a strong support system, and they go in and ensure that strong support system by providing the locals in Syria and Iraq with everything that they need. And then those people, in turn, seeing them as better than the Americans, provide them with the cover and the protection that they need so that they can integrate, so that ISIS can integrate into society and have a fully functioning society. We could take way less of that money, go in and appeal to those folks, provide them with food, provide them with fresh water, provide them with housing. That's welfare! Right, and it is. And I understand that it's not the kind of welfare that you're used to supporting, which is the kind that only supports military contractors, which is only the kind that supports those who make arms. Only, we're never going to stabilize the region by blowing things up. We need to appeal to the people. And here in America, we see ISIS as way worse. We see ISIS as way worse because that's our bias. We think what America is doing is fine. What ISIS is doing is terrible. When you go over to the Middle East, Syria and some of these other countries, they see what we're doing is awful. And what ISIS is doing is by and large A-okay. Because our drone strikes are killing a lot of innocent people. So it goes like this. Start pulling those folks out of there. Start pulling the drones out of there. Begin appealing to the people. Begin appealing to their leaders, if they have any leaders that are not ISIS anymore. Provide them with those things that they need, those basic human needs. Gain their trust. Take back the region that way. I swear to you, what we're doing right now, though it's very profitable for some very evil companies, it's not doing us any good. And there's a 100% failure rate. There's a 100% chance that it is not going to work. So there's my plan. Is anybody listening? The odds are no. And yeah, I've contacted my legislators about this. And they don't care either. This plan is never going to be put into place. And why is it not going to be put into place? One, because it's cost effective. Two, because it will work. And three, fear. Fear is incredibly profitable.
Silence. Not me. Not anymore. I will no longer stand here absorbing the faux concern, contrived gravity, and tepid smugness of a house complicit in the weekly bloodshed. Sooner or later, the country will hold us accountable for our inaction. But as you bow your head and think of what you say to your God, when you are asked what you did to slow the slaughter of innocents, there will be silence.
The Democrats went to the floor in the House this week. There was a vote, there was a filibuster in the Senate last week. And after a 15-hour filibuster, the Republicans finally allowed a vote on four weapons reforms that would have at least limited the ability of terrorists to get weapons, terrorists or potential terrorists, or really anybody that doesn't deserve to have or doesn't need to have a weapon. All four came up, all four were voted down. So the Democrats decided to hold a sit-in, and we're going to stop the House of Representatives from going home on their 4th of July break. And they gave speeches on the floor for about 25 hours. In about the 17th or 18th hour, the Republicans in the House decided to slink out at about 2 or 3 in the morning and just go on their break anyway. And the Democrats kept up their sit-in until they finally stopped the following morning, 25 hours after it had started. And they said, after the 4th of July break, they will be back and they will be doing this again. Because what we're doing with respect to our gun policy is we're helping arm the terrorists. And I know that's not a popular opinion, but if you say that and they go, well, since the terrorists are armed, then we need to be armed. Everybody just needs to be armed all the time with as many guns as possible. Wait, no, you can't do that. Now, it breaks decorum in the House of Representatives when you do that. There's no filibuster there. So they're breaking the rules when they do this in the House. And they're doing something that has never, ever been done before.
We have lost hundreds and thousands of innocent people to gun violence. Tiny little children, babies, students, and teachers, mothers and fathers, sisters and brothers, daughters and sons, friends and neighbors. And what has this body done? Mr. Speaker, nothing. Not one thing. We have turned deaf ears to the blood of the innocent and the concern of our nation. We are blind to a crisis. We cannot continue to stick our heads in the sand and ignore the reality of mass gun violence in our nation. Deadly mass shootings are becoming more and more frequent. Mr. Speaker, this is the fight. It is not an opinion. We must remove the blinders. The time for silence and patience is long gone.
This from CNN, Zachary Cohen over at CNN. A new report from a prominent human rights group has found that ISIS has built a substantial arsenal, including U.S.-made weapons obtained from the Iraqi army and Syrian opposition groups. Amnesty International's 44-page report found that much of ISIS equipment and munitions come from stockpiles captured from the U.S.-allied Iraqi military and Syrian rebels. After analyzing thousands of videos and images in Iraq and Syria, Amnesty determined that a large proportion of ISIS's current military arsenal is made up of weapons and equipment looted or captured or illicitly traded from poorly secured Iraqi military stocks. These weapons include many accumulated by Iraq over five war-torn decades, were designed or manufactured in 25 countries and range from assault rifles to tanks to anti-aircraft missiles. Amnesty International found that the quantity and range of ISIS arms and ammunition ultimately reflects decades of irresponsible arms transfers to Iraq and multiple failures by the U.S.-led occupation administration to manage arms deliveries and stocks securely, as well as endemic corruption in Iraq itself. By failing to account for the weapons that have been transferred to Iraq over the last several decades, the U.S. and other supplier nations have allowed them to freely flow through the region and fall into the hands of ISIS and other armed groups in the region. This was concluded by the Human Rights Group. So you don't just have ISIS killing people here in America with our own weapons, thanks to our gun laws. You also have it over in the region where they control, the region that Daesh controls, because the Iraq war gave them all of the weapons and munitions that they need to kill the Americans. We are arming, we are intentionally and consciously arming our own enemies. And we don't want to do anything about it. Not because we're dumb, but because it's very, very profitable to the makers of those weapons. And oh yeah, fear is the mind killer. Fear is very, very paralyzing. Even if ISIS is uprooted, other armed groups will be there to take their place if the issue of proliferation continues. So if we continue to be in the region carrying out the way we've been carrying out, once again, you can't kill an idea. And what they're operating on right now is an idea. And who they're being armed by right now is the Americans. Just like here in our own country, being armed by the Americans. This from Newsweek. Researchers at Indiana State University examining incidents of lone wolf terrorism in the U.S. found that prior to the Al-Qaeda attacks on America on 9/11, domestic terrorists more often used bombs to perpetuate their attacks. However, in the last 14 years, thanks to loose gun laws, they have increasingly turned to guns as their primary weapon of choice. Data gathered by the Government Accountability Office also supports this trend. Individuals on the Consolidated Terror Watch List, including notorious terrorists such as Al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri, attempted to purchase guns from licensed dealers 2,233 times between February 2004 and December 2014. In nearly 10% of these cases, the FBI was able to find something else in their criminal history to block the sale, but the FBI lacked the authority to block sales in 2,043 of the cases because of gaps in current laws. The weakness in our gun laws is not a secret. In 2011, American-born Al-Qaeda propagandist Ahmed Gadan urged his followers to take advantage of our weak gun laws to arm up, explaining, quote, America is absolutely awash in easily obtainable firearms. You go down to the gun show at your local convention center and come away with a fully automatic assault rifle without a background check and most likely without having to show an identification card. So what are you waiting for? Unquote.
You make almost $200,000 a year to write rules, to make our society better, not tweet, not tell us about your thoughts and prayers, to write rules to make our society better. You know, we look to you guys as our leaders, and ultimately it comes down to money and influence. And right now, since 1998, the NRA has given $3.7 million to Congress. There are 294 sitting members of Congress that have accepted contributions from the NRA, and that doesn't even include the millions of dollars from outside lobbying. If we raise $4 million, would you guys take that to save lives? And is this what you want your legacy to be? That you were a could-have-done-something Congress, but you didn't because of outside lobbying? That you were complicit in the deaths of thousands of Americans? And look, I know being a member of Congress is hard. You got to placate your base. You got to look out for re-election. You got to answer to lobbyists. But please, persevere, because our thoughts and prayers are with you. Good night.
We have the solution. What we lack, though, is the will. We don't want to do anything about it because we see it as a fundamental freedom to own a weapon. And I'm not for taking away the right to own a weapon. But the way, and these two issues are together, they are intertwined. The way we conduct ourselves, have conducted ourselves in the Middle East over the last number of decades, the way we're conducting ourselves in America right now, we are intentionally killing ourselves. We are intentionally killing each other. We are arming our own enemies. And the solution is an easy one. Here in America, and by the way, we're probably never, ever going to get rid of all of these mass shootings. Okay, I understand the gun buyback that took place in Australia, but Australia is much more sparsely populated and a lot more rural. America's not like that. So we'll probably never, ever get rid of all of the mass shootings. But if we could just, avoid a few of them, just limit them to some degree, that would be fantastic. That would be the best. And then, of course, we've got a solution for the Middle East, too. A better way to win hearts and minds and to win over, to win the Middle East and to defeat ISIL, Daesh, in the Middle East. But we're not going to do that. And here in America, it's likely we're not going to do that either. I want to leave you with this, if you remember nothing else from this show. And I know it seems super simplistic in some of the terms I put these things in, but we're Americans. We can do anything. And I know that we can do anything. Senator Chris Murphy last week held a 15-hour filibuster in the Senate where a lot of senators got up and they told stories and made the case for some sensible gun control. And when it ended after 15 hours, Senator Murphy hit the floor with a story. And this is the way he closed it out. Please, whatever you're doing, if you're sitting at home, if you're walking down the street, just stop for a minute. Set everything aside for a minute. And please, listen to this story. Listen to the way he closed out that filibuster.
I want to introduce you to Dylan Christopher Jack Hockley, who in this picture is age 6. According to just about everybody who knew him, it was impossible not to fall in love with Dylan Hockley if you met him. Dylan was struggling with autism as a student at Sandy Hook Elementary School. But he was a special, special boy who is going to turn in to a special, special young man. He idolized a woman named Anne Marie Murphy. Anne Marie Murphy was his special education teacher and his personal aide. And over the course of the beginning of his first grade year, they formed a bond, a deep, deep bond that is often hard to form for kids with autism, like Dylan. It meant something to him to have that relationship. And he loved going to school in large part because he knew he had someone there who loved him back. When Adam Lanza walked into that classroom and aimed his military-style assault weapon with clips attached to it, holding 30 bullets, Anne Marie Murphy probably had a chance to run or to hide or to panic. And instead, Anne Marie Murphy made the most courageous decision that any of us could imagine. Instead of running, instead of hiding, instead of panicking, Anne Marie Murphy found Dylan Hockley and embraced him. You know why we know that? Because when the police entered the classroom, that's how they found Dylan Hockley, dead, wrapped in the embrace of Anne Marie Murphy. It doesn't take courage to stand here on the floor of the United States Senate for 2 hours or 6 hours or 14 hours. It doesn't take courage to stand up to the gun lobby when 90% of your constituents want change to happen. It takes courage to look into the eye of a shooter and instead of running, wrapping your arms around a 6-year-old boy and accepting death as a trade for just a tiny little itty beast piece of increased peace of mind for a little boy under your charge. And so this has been a day of questions. And so I ask you all this question. If Anne Marie Murphy could do that, then ask yourself, what can you do to make sure that Orlando or Sandy Hook never, ever happens again? With deep gratitude to all of those who have endured this very, very late night, I yield the floor.
The policy that we're carrying out in the Middle East is not courageous, nor is it effective, and we have nothing to show for it. The policy that we are perpetuating here in America is also not courageous. And it's also not effective. and it's not doing anything good for us. We know what the solutions are. We know what we have to do. What we lack, of course, is the will. I don't know if I've changed your mind today. I don't know that I'll ever change anybody's mind on this subject, but I did want to create a record that said, yes, some of us that are here right now recognize what this problem is, recognize where we went wrong, and fully recognize what we need to do next. And it's going to be hard to build a coalition on this, but it's worth it. This is absolutely worth it for us. I can't sit aside and hear too many more of these stories. My heart can't break any more than it is already broken. My tear ducts have gone dry, and a lot of us are just ending up dead inside to where we don't even respond to these stories anymore. We're losing that, what makes us human, and it's something we're never going to get back if we don't do something and do something now. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here on The Fire You Can't Put Out. Our official home is tfycpo.podbean.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/tfycpo. You can listen on the go. Just download the Podbean app at the iTunes Store or at the Google Play Store for Android users. Oh, by the way, we are also still on Kiwi Station. Thank you, Kiwi. Individual episodes are available for download at the iTunes Store or at Podbean. Just search for The Fire You Can't Put Out there. You can also subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Questions, comments, or hate mail, or just a general statement or inquiry, you can email us at tfycpo@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform and entertain, but also to keep an open dialogue with our growing listener base. So feel free to reach out to us. And as always, thank you for listening. We are The Fire You Can't Put Out, and we will prevail. Rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. Special thanks to Kevin for producing, and a special thanks to you for listening. This is Melvin, signing off. Now that I've woken you up, good morning, America.